something wrong with Henri, and I wanted to see whether Madame had some different method, Caterina went on. They used to go to bed in the afternoon. My maids found a place from which I could watch them. What an astonishing picture, Alison thought. The Queen gazing through some kind of peephole at her husband in bed with his mistress. It was very hard for me to look, because he obviously adored her. And I didn't learn anything. They played some games I didn't know about, but in the end he fucked her the same way he fucked me. The only difference was how much more he enjoyed it with her. Caterina spoke in a dry, bitter voice. She was not emotional, but Alison was close to tears. It must have broken Caterina's heart, she thought. She wanted to ask questions, but she was afraid of disturbing this confiding mood. I tried all kinds of remedies, some of them utterly disgusting. Poultices of dung on my vagina, that kind of thing. Nothing worked. Then I met Dr. Fernel, and I found out what was stopping me getting pregnant. Alison was fascinated. What was it? The king's cock is short and fat, adorable, but not long. He wasn't putting it in far enough, and my maidenhead had never been broken, so the spunk didn't go all the way up. The doctor broke the membrane with a special implement, and a month later I was pregnant with Francis. Pronto. There was a huge cheer from the crowd outside, as if they had been listening to the story and heard its happy ending. Alison guessed that the king must have mounted his horse for the next bout. Caterina put a hand on Alison's knee, as if to detain her a moment longer. Dr. Fernelli stayed, but his son is just as good, she said. Tell Mary to see him. Alison wondered why the Queen did not give this message to Mary herself. As if reading her mind, Caterina said, Mary is proud. If I give her the impression that I think she might be barren, she could take offense. Advice such as this comes better from a friend than from a mother-in-law. I understand. Do this as a kindness to me. It was courteous of the Queen to request what she might command. Of course, Alison said. Caterina stood up and went to the window. The others in the room crowded around her, Alison included, and looked out. Along the middle of the road, two fences enclosed a long, narrow track. At one end was the king's horse, called Malheureux. At the other, the mount of Gabriel, Count of Montgomery. Down the middle of the track ran a barrier to keep the two horses from colliding. The king was talking to Montgomery in the middle of the field. Their words could not be heard from the palace window, but they seemed to be arguing. The tournament was almost over, and some spectators were already leaving, but Alison guessed the combative king wanted to play a final bout. Then the king raised his voice, and everyone heard him say, "That's an order." Montgomery gave a bow of obedience and put his helmet on. The king did the same, and both men returned to the ends of the track. Henri lowered his visor. Alison heard Caterina murmur, "Fasten it shut, chérie," and the king turned the catch that prevented the eyepiece flying up. Henri was impatient and did not wait for the trumpet, but kicked his horse and charged. Montgomery did the same. The horses were destriers, bred for war, big and tremendously strong, and their hooves made a noise like a titan beating the earth with giant drumsticks. Alison felt her pulse quicken with exhilaration and fear. The two riders picked up speed. The crowd cheered wildly as the war horses pounded toward one another, ribbons flying. The two men angled their wooden lances across the central barrier. The weapons had blunted tips. The object was not to injure the opponent, but simply to knock him from his saddle. All the same, Alison was glad that only men played this sport. She would have been terrified. At the last moment, both men clamped their legs tightly into the horse and leaned forward. They met with a terrific crash. Montgomery's lance struck the king's head. The lance damaged the helmet. The king's visor flew up, and Alison understood in a flash that the impact had snapped the visor catch. The lance broke in two. The tremendous momentum of the horses continued to carry both men forward, and a fraction of a second later, the broken end of Montgomery's lance struck the king's face again. He reeled in the saddle, looking as if he might be losing consciousness. Caterina screamed in fear. Alison saw Duke Scarface leap the fence and run to the king. Several more noblemen did the same. They steadied the horse, then lifted the king from the saddle, with great effort because of his heavy armor, and lowered him to the ground. Cardinal Charles ran after his brother Scarface, and Pierre followed close on his heels. When the king's helmet was gingerly removed, they saw immediately that he had suffered a serious wound. His face was covered in blood. A long, thick splinter of wood was sticking out of his eye. Other splinters were lodged in his face and head. He lay still, apparently numbed to pain and barely conscious. His doctor was in attendance in case of just such an incident as this, and he now knelt beside the patient. Charles looked hard at the king for a long moment, then backed away. "He will die," he murmured to Pierre. Pierre was thrown. What did this mean for the Guise family, whose future was Pierre's future? The long-term plan that Charles had only just outlined to him was now in ruins. Pierre felt a degree of anxiety close to panic. "It's too soon," he said. He realized that his voice was oddly high-pitched. Making an effort to speak more calmly, he said, "Francis cannot rule this country." Charles moved farther away from the crowd to make sure they could not be overheard, though no one was paying attention to anyone but the king now. "According to French law, a king can rule at 14. Francis is 15. True. Pierre began to think hard. His panic evaporated and logic took over his brain. "But Francis will have help," he said, "and whoever becomes his closest advisor will be the true king of France." Throwing caution to the winds, he moved closer to Charles and spoke in a low, urgent voice. "Cardinal, you must be that man." Charles gave him a sharp look of a kind that Pierre recognized. It indicated that he had surprised Charles by saying something Charles had not thought of. "You're right," Charles said slowly, "but the natural choice would be Antoine of Bourbon. He is the first prince of the blood." A prince of the blood was a direct male descendant of a French king. Such men were the highest aristocracy outside the royal family itself. They took precedence over all other noblemen, and Antoine was the most senior among them. "God forbid," said Pierre, "if Antoine becomes the principal advisor to King Francis II, the power of the Guise family will be at an end." "And so will my career," he added silently. Antoine was King of Navarre, a small country between France and Spain. More importantly, he was head of the Bourbon family, who, together with the Montmorency clan, were the great rivals of the Guises. Their religious policies were fluid, but the Bourbon-Montmorency alliance tended to be less hard-line on heresy than the Guises and was therefore favored by the Protestants, a type of support that was not always welcome. If Antoine controlled the boy king, the Guises would become impotent. It did not bear thinking about. Charles said, "Antoine is stupid and a suspected Protestant. And most importantly, he's out of town."
"Yes, he's at Pau."
The residence of the kings of Navarre was in the foothills of the Pyrenees Mountains, 500 miles from Paris.
"But messengers will be on their way to him before nightfall," Pierre said insistently. "You can neutralize Antoine, but only if you act fast." "I must speak to my niece, Mary Stuart. She will be Queen of France. She must persuade the new king to reject Antoine as advisor."
Pierre shook his head. Charles was thinking, but Pierre was ahead of him.
"Mary is a beautiful child. She cannot be relied upon in something as important as this." "Caterina, then. She is soft on Protestants, and might have no objection to Antoine. I have a better idea."
"Go on."
Charles was listening to Pierre as he might to an equal. Pierre felt a glow of pleasure. His political acumen had won the respect of the most able politician in France.
"Tell Caterina that if she will accept you and your brother as the king's leading counselors, You will banish Diane de Poitiers from the court for the rest of her life. Charles thought for a long moment. Then he nodded, very slowly, once. Alison was secretly thrilled by the injury to King Henri. She put on plain white morning clothes and even managed to force tears occasionally, but that was for show. In her heart, she rejoiced. Mary Stuart was about to be Queen of France, and Alison was her best friend. The king had been carried into the palace of Tournelle, and the court gathered around his sick room. He took a long time dying, but there was little doubt about the eventual outcome. Among his doctors was Ambroise Paré, the surgeon who had removed the spearhead from the cheeks of Duke François of Guise, leaving the scars that had given the duke his nickname. Paré said that if the splinter had penetrated only the king's eye, he might have survived, provided the wound did not become fatally infected. But in fact, the point had gone farther and entered the brain. Paré conducted experiments on 4 condemned criminals, sticking splinters into their eyes to replicate the wound, but all of them died, and there was no hope for the king. Mary Stuart's 15-year-old husband, soon to be King Francis II, became infantile. He lay in bed, moaning incomprehensibly, rocking in a lunatic rhythm, and had to be restrained from banging his head against the wall. Even Mary and Alison, who had been his friends since childhood, resented that he was so useless. Queen Caterina, who had never really possessed her husband, was nevertheless distraught at the prospect of losing him. However, she showed her ruthless side by banning her rival, Diane de Poitiers, from the king's presence. Twice, Alison saw Caterina deep in conversation with Cardinal Charles, who might have been giving her spiritual consolation, but more probably was helping her plan a smooth succession. Both times they were attended by Pierre Aumond, the handsome, mysterious young man who had appeared from nowhere a year or so ago and was at Charles's side more and more often. King Henri was given extreme unction on the morning of July 9th. Shortly after 1 o'clock that day, Mary and Alison were at lunch in their rooms at the chateau when Pierre Aumond came in. He bowed deeply and said to Mary, "The king is sinking fast. We must act now." This was the moment they had all been waiting for. Mary did not pretend to be distraught or have hysterics. She swallowed, put down her knife and spoon, patted her lips with a napkin, and said, "What must I do?" Alison felt proud of her mistress's composure. Pierre said, "You must help your husband. The Duke of Guise is with him now. We are all going immediately to the Louvre with Queen Caterina." Alison said, "You're taking possession of the person of the new king." Pierre looked sharply at her. He was the kind of man, she realized, who saw only important people. The rest were invisible. Now he gave her an appraising look. "That's exactly right," he said. "The Queen Mother is in agreement with your mistress's Uncle Francois and Uncle Charles. At this moment of danger, Francis must turn for help to his wife, Queen Mary, and no one else." Alison knew that was rubbish. Francois and Charles wanted the new king to turn to Francois and Charles. Mary was merely their cover. In the moment of uncertainty that always followed the death of a king, the man with the power was not the new king himself, but whoever had him in his hands. That was why Alison had said, "possession of the person," the phrase that had alerted Pierre to the fact that she knew what was going on. Mary would not have figured this out, Alison guessed, but that did not matter. Pierre's plan was good for Mary. She would be all the more powerful in alliance with her uncles. By contrast, Antoine of Bourbon would surely try to sideline Mary if he gained control of Francis. So, when Mary looked at Alison inquiringly, Alison gave a slight nod. Mary said, "Very well," and stood up. Watching Pierre's face, Alison saw that he had not missed that little interaction. Alison went with Mary to Francis's room, and Pierre followed. The door was guarded by men-at-arms. Alison recognized their leader, Gaston Lepin, a tough-looking character who was chief of the Guise family's paid roughnecks. They were willing to hold Francis by force if necessary, Alison deduced. Francis was weeping, but getting dressed, helped by his servants. Both Duke Scarface and Cardinal Charles were there, watching impatiently, and a moment later Queen Caterina came in. This was the group taking power, Alison realized. Francis's mother had made a deal with Mary's uncles. Alison considered who might try to stop them. The leading candidate would be the Duke of Montmorency, who held the title of Constable of France. But Montmorency's royal ally, Antoine of Bourbon, never quick off the mark, had not yet arrived in Paris. The Guises were in a strong position, Alison saw. All the same, they were right to act now. Things could change quickly. An advantage was no use unless it was seized. Pierre said to Alison, "The new king and queen will occupy the royal apartments at the Louvre Palace immediately. The Duke of Guise will move into the suite of Diane de Poitiers, and Cardinal Charles will occupy the rooms of the Duke of Montmorency." Clever, Alison thought. "So the Guise family will have the king and the palace." Pierre looked pleased with himself, and Alison guessed that might have been his idea. She added, "So you have effectively neutralized the rival faction." Pierre said, "There is no rival faction." "Of course not," she said. "Silly me." He looked at her with something like respect. That pleased her, and she realized that she was drawn to this clever, confident young man. "You and I could be allies," she thought, "and perhaps something more." Living most of her life at the French court, she had come to regard marriage the way noblemen did, as a strategic alliance rather than a bond of love. She and Pierre Aumont might be a formidable couple, and after all, it would be no hardship to wake up in the morning next to a man who looked like that. The party went down the grand staircase, crossed the hall, and walked out onto the steps. Outside the gate, a crowd of Parisians waited to see what was going to happen. They cheered when they saw Francis. They too knew he would soon be their king. Carriages stood in the forecourt, guarded by more of the Guises' bully boys. Alison noticed that the vehicles were placed so that everyone in the crowd would see who got in. Gaston Lepin opened the door of the first carriage. The Duke of Guise walked slowly forward with Francis. The crowd knew Scarface, and they could all see that he had the king in his charge. This had been carefully choreographed, Alison realized. Francis walked to the carriage, went up the single step, and got inside without making a fool of himself, to Alison's great relief. Caterina and Mary went next. At the step, Mary held back to let Caterina go first, but Caterina shook her head and waited. Holding her head high, Mary got into the carriage. Pierre asked his confessor, "Is it a sin to marry someone you don't love?" Father Moineau was a square-faced, heavy-set priest in his 50s. His study in the Collège des Âmes contained more books than Sylvie's father's shop. He was a rather prissy intellectual, but he enjoyed the company of young men and he was popular with the students. He knew all about the work Pierre was doing for Cardinal Charles.
"Certainly not," Moineau said.
His voice was a rich baritone, somewhat roughened by a fondness for strong Canary wine.
"Noblemen are obliged so to do. It might even be a sin for a king to marry someone he did love."
He chuckled. He liked paradoxes, as did all the teachers. But Pierre was in a serious mood.
"I'm going to wreck Sylvie's life."
Moineau was fond of Pierre, and clearly would have liked their intimacy to be physical, but he had quickly understood that Pierre was not one of those men who loved men, and had never done anything more than pat him affectionately on the back. Now Moineau caught his tone and became somber.
"I see that," he said, "and you want to know whether you would be doing God's will."
"Exactly." Pierre was not often troubled by his conscience, but he had never done anyone as much harm as he was about to do to Sylvie.
"Listen to me," said Moineau. 4 years ago, a terrible error was committed. It is known as the Pacification of Augsburg, and it is a treaty that allows individual German provinces to choose to follow the heresy of Lutheranism
if their ruler so wishes. For the first time, there are places in the world where it is not a crime to be a Protestant. This is a catastrophe for the Christian faith. Pierre said in Latin, Cuius regio, eius religio. This was the slogan of the Augsburg Treaty, and it meant, whose realm, his religion. Moineau continued, in signing the agreement, the emperor, Charles V, hoped to end religious conflict. But what has happened? Earlier this year, the accursed Queen Elizabeth of England imposed Protestantism on her wretched subjects, who are now deprived of the consolation of the sacraments. Tolerance is spreading. This is the horrible truth, and we have to do whatever we can to stop it. Your terminology is precise. Whatever we can. And we now have a young king, much under the influence of the Guise family. Heaven has sent us an opportunity to crack down. Look, I know how you feel. No man of sensibility likes to see people burned to death. You've told me about Sylvie, and she seems to be a normal girl. Somewhat too lascivious, perhaps. He chuckled again, then resumed his grave tone. In most respects, poor Sylvie is no more than a victim of her wicked parents, who have brought her up in heresy. But this is what Protestants do. They convert others, and their victims lose their immortal souls. So you're saying I will not be doing anything wrong by marrying Sylvie and then betraying her? On the contrary, said Moineau, you will be doing God's will, and you will be rewarded in heaven, I assure you. That was what Pierre had wanted to hear. Thank you, he said. God bless you, my son, said Father Moineau. Sylvie married Pierre on the last Sunday in September. Their Catholic wedding took place on the Saturday, in the parish church. But Sylvie did not count that. It was a legal requirement, nothing more. They spent Saturday night apart. On Sunday they had their real wedding at the Forest Hunting Lodge that served as a Protestant church. It was a mild day between summer and autumn, cloudy but dry. Sylvie's dress was a soft, dove grey, and Pierre said the colour made her skin glow and her eyes shine. Pierre himself was devastatingly handsome in his new coat from Dubœuf. Pastor Bernard conducted the service, and the Marquis of Nîmes was the witness. When Sylvie made her vows, she was overcome by a feeling of serenity, as if her life had at last begun. Afterward, the entire congregation was invited back to the bookshop. They filled the shop and the apartment upstairs. Sylvie and her mother had spent all week preparing food. Saffron broth, pork pies with ginger, cheese and onion tarts, custard pastries, apple fritters, quince cheese. Sylvie's father was uncharacteristically genial, pouring wine into flat-bottomed glasses and offering platters of food. Everyone ate and drank standing up, except for the bridal couple and the Marquis and Marchioness, who were privileged to sit at the dining table. Sylvie thought Pierre seemed a little tense, which was unusual for him. In general, he was at his relaxed best on big social occasions, listening attentively to the men and charming the women, never failing to say that a new baby was beautiful, no matter what it looked like. But today he was restless. He went to the window twice, and when the cathedral bells struck the hour, he jumped. Sylvie guessed he was worried about being at a Protestant gathering in the heart of the city. Relax, she said to him. This is just an ordinary wedding celebration. No one knows we're Protestants. Of course, he said, and smiled anxiously. Sylvie was thinking mainly about tonight. She was looking forward to it eagerly, but she was also just a little nervous. Losing your virginity doesn't hurt much, and it's only for a second, her mother had said. Some girls hardly feel it, and don't worry if you don't bleed. Not everyone does. Sylvie was not actually worried about that. She was longing for the physical intimacy of lying in bed with Pierre, kissing him and touching him to her heart's content, without having to hold back. Her anxiety was about whether he would love her body. She felt it was not perfect for him. Statues of women always had perfectly matched breasts, whereas hers were not quite the same, and naked women in paintings had almost invisible private parts, sometimes covered just with a faint down. But hers were plump and hairy. What would he think when he looked for the first time? She was too embarrassed to share these worries with her mother. It crossed her mind to ask Marchioness Louise, who was only 3 years older and had a conspicuously large bust. Then, just as she decided that Louise was not approachable enough, her thoughts were interrupted. She heard raised voices down in the shop, then someone screamed. Strangely, Pierre went to the window again, though the noise undoubtedly came from inside the building. She heard breaking glass. What was going on? It sounded more and more like a fight. Had someone got drunk? How could they spoil her wedding day? The Marquis and Marchioness looked fearful. Pierre had turned pale. He stood with his back to the window, looking through the open door to the landing and the staircase. Sylvie ran to the top of the stairs. Through a rear window, she saw some of the guests fleeing through the backyard. As she looked down the stairs, a man she did not know started to come up. He wore a leather jerkin and carried a club. She realized with horror that this was worse than a drunken brawl among the wedding guests. It was an official raid. Her anger turned to fear. Scared by the brute coming up the stairs, she ran back into the dining room. The man followed her. He was short and powerfully built, and he had lost most of one ear. He looked terrifying. All the same, Pastor Bernard, who was a frail 55-year-old, stood in front of him and said bravely, "Who are you and what do you want?"
"I'm Gaston Lepin, captain of the Guise family household guard, and you're a blaspheming heretic," the man said.
He raised his club and struck the pastor. Bernard turned away from the blow, but it caught him across the shoulders, and he fell to the ground. Lepin looked at the other guests, who were trying to press themselves into the walls.
"Anyone else got any questions?"
he said. No one spoke. Two more thugs came into the room and stood behind Lepin. Then, incomprehensibly, Lepin addressed Pierre.
"Which one is the Marquis?"
he said. Sylvie was bewildered. What was going on? Even more bafflingly, Pierre pointed to the Marquis of Nîmes.
Lepin said, "And I suppose the bitch with the big tits is the Marchioness."
Pierre nodded dumbly. Sylvie felt as if the world had been turned upside down. Her wedding had become a violent nightmare in which no one was what they seemed. Marchioness Louise stood up and said indignantly to Lepin,
"How dare you?"
Lepin slapped her face hard. She screamed and fell back. Her cheek reddened instantly, and she began to cry. The portly old Marquis half rose from his chair, realized it was pointless, and sat back down again. Lepin spoke to the men who had followed him in.
"Take those two, and make sure they don't get away."
The Marquis and Marchioness were dragged from the room. Pastor Bernard, still on the floor, pointed at Pierre and said,
"You devil, you're a spy."
Everything fell into place in Sylvie's mind. Pierre had organized this raid, she realized with horror. He had infiltrated the congregation in order to betray them. He had pretended to fall in love with her, only to win their trust. That was why he had dithered so long about the date of the wedding. She stared at him aghast, seeing a monster where once there had been the man she loved. It was as if her arm had been chopped off and she was looking at the bleeding stump, except that this hurt more. It was not just her wedding day that was ruined, it was her whole life. She wanted to die. She moved toward Pierre.
"How could you?"
she screamed, advancing on him, not knowing what she intended to do.
"Judas Iscariot, how could you?"
Then something hit her on the back of the head, and the world went black.
"One thing troubled me about the coronation,"
said Pierre to Cardinal Charles. They were at the vast Guise family palace in the Vieille Rue de Temple, in the opulent small parlour where Pierre had first met Charles and his scarred elder brother, François. Charles had bought more paintings since then, all biblical scenes, but highly charged with sexuality, Adam and Eve, Susanna and the elders, Potiphar's wife. Sometimes Charles was interested in what Pierre had to say. At other times he would shut Pierre up with a casually dismissive flick of his long, elegant fingers. Today he was in a receptive mood.
"Go on."
Pierre quoted, "Francis and Mary, by the grace of God, King and Queen of France, Scotland, England, and Ireland. As indeed they are. Francis is King of France, Mary is the Queen of Scots, and by right of inheritance, and by the authority of the Pope, Mary is Queen of England and Ireland. And they have those words carved on their new furniture, and embossed on the Queen's new dining plates for all to see, including the English ambassador.
Your point is,
by encouraging Mary Stuart to tell the world she is the rightful Queen of England, we have made an enemy of Queen Elizabeth.
So what? Elizabeth is hardly a threat to us.
But what have we achieved? When we make an enemy, there should be some benefit to us. Otherwise, we have harmed only ourselves. A look of greed came over Charles' long face.
We're going to rule over the greatest European empire since Charlemagne, he said.
It will be greater than that of Felipe of Spain, because his dominions are scattered, and therefore impossible to govern, whereas the new French empire will be compact, its wealth and strength concentrated. We will hold sway from Edinburgh to Marseille, and control the ocean from the North Sea to the Bay of Biscay. Pierre took the risk of arguing. If we're serious, we would have done better to conceal our intentions from the English. Now they are forewarned.
And what will they do?
Elizabeth rules a poor and barbarous country that has no army.
It has a navy.
Not much of one. But given the difficulty of attacking an island? Charles gave the flick of the fingers that indicated he had lost interest.
On to a more immediate topic, he said.
He handed Pierre a sheet of heavyweight paper with an official seal.
There it is, he said, the annulment of your marriage.
Pierre took the paper gratefully. The grounds were clear. The marriage had never been consummated, but even so, it could be difficult to get an annulment. He felt relieved.
That was quick. I'm not a cardinal for nothing, and it was gutsy of you to go through with the ceremony.
It was worth it. Hundreds of Protestants had been arrested all over the city in a coordinated series of raids planned by Charles and Pierre. Even if most of them have been let off with fines.
If they recant their beliefs, we can't burn them to death, especially if they're aristocrats, like the Marquis of Nîmes and his wife. Pastor Bernard will die. He refused to recant, even under torture.
And we found parts of a French Bible in the print shop, so your ex-wife's father can't escape punishment by recanting.
Gilles Palot will burn.
All of which makes the Guise family Catholic heroes,
thanks to you.
Pierre bowed his head in acknowledgement, glowing with pride. His satisfaction was profound. This was what he had wanted, to be the trusted aide to the most powerful man in the land. It was his moment of triumph. He tried not to show just how exultant he felt. Charles said,
"But there's another reason why I was in a hurry to get you an annulment."
Pierre frowned. What now? Charles was the only man in Paris who was as devious as Pierre himself. Charles went on.
There's someone else I want you to marry.
Good God! Pierre was rocked. He had not been expecting that. His thoughts immediately flew to Véronique de Guise. Had Charles changed his mind about letting Pierre marry her? His heart filled with hope. Was it possible that two dreams could come true? Charles said,
"My nephew, Alain, who is only 14, has seduced a maid and got her pregnant. He can't possibly marry her."
Pierre's spirits fell with a painful crash.
A maid? Alain will have an arranged political marriage, like all Guise men, except those of us who are called to the priesthood. But I'd like to take care of the maid. I feel sure you'll understand that, having been born in similar circumstances. Pierre felt sick. He had thought the triumph he and Charles had enjoyed might elevate his status closer to that of a member of the family. Instead, he was being reminded of how far below them he really was.
You want me to marry a maid?
Charles laughed. Don't speak as if it's a death sentence. More like life imprisonment. What was he going to do about this? Charles did not like to be thwarted. If Pierre refused this demand, it could blight his flowering career. We'll give you a pension, Charles said. 50 livres a month.
I don't care about money.
Charles raised his eyebrows at the insolence of an interruption. Indeed? What do you care about? Pierre realized there was one reward that might make the sacrifice worthwhile. I want the right to call myself Pierre Aumond de Guise. Marry her and we'll see.
No.
Pierre knew he was risking everything now. My name on the marriage certificate must be Pierre Aumond de Guise, otherwise I will not sign it. He had never been this audacious with Charles. He held his breath, waiting for the reaction, dreading an explosion. Charles said, You're a determined little bastard, aren't you?
I wouldn't be so useful to you otherwise.
That's true. Charles was silent and thoughtful for a minute. Then he said, All right. I'll agree. Pierre felt weak with relief. Charles said, From now on you are Pierre Aumond de Guise.
Thank you.
The girl is in the next room along the corridor. Go and see her. Get acquainted. Pierre got up and went to the door. Be nice to her. Charles added, Give her a kiss. Pierre left the room without replying. Outside the door he stood still for a moment, feeling shaky, trying to take it all in. He did not know whether to be elated or dismayed. He had escaped from one unwanted marriage only to fall into another. But he was a Guise. He pulled himself together. He had better take a look at his wife-to-be. She was low class, obviously, but she might be pretty, given that she had enticed Alain de Guise. On the other hand, it did not take much to win the sexual interest of a boy of 14. Willingness was the most important attraction. He walked along the passage to the next door and went in without knocking. A girl sat on the sofa with her head in her hands, weeping. She wore the plain dress of a servant. She was quite plump, Pierre saw, perhaps on account of the pregnancy. When he closed the door behind him, she looked up. He knew her. It was plain Odette, the maid of Véronique. She would forever remind him of the girl he had not been allowed to marry. Odette recognized him and smiled bravely through her tears, showing her crooked teeth.
Are you my savior?
She said. God help me, said Pierre. After Gilles Palot was burned to death, Sylvie's mother went into a depression. For Sylvie, this was the most shocking of the traumas she suffered, more seismic than Pierre's betrayal, even sadder than her father's execution. In Sylvie's mind, her mother was a rock that could never crumble, the foundation of her life. Isabel had put salve on her childish injuries, fed her when she was hungry, and calmed her father's volcanic temper. But now Isabel was helpless. She sat in a chair all day. If Sylvie lit a fire, Isabel would look at it. If Sylvie prepared food, Isabel would eat it mechanically. If Sylvie did not help her get dressed, Isabel would spend all day in her underclothes. Gilles' fate had been sealed when a stack of newly printed sheets for Bibles in French had been found in the shop. The sheets were ready to be cut into pages and bound into volumes, after which they would have been taken to the secret warehouse in the Rue de Mur. But there had not been time to finish them. So Gilles was guilty. Not just of heresy, but of promoting heresy. There had been no mercy for him. In the eyes of the church,
The Bible was the most dangerous of all banned books, especially translated into French or English, with marginal notes explaining how certain passages proved the correctness of Protestant teaching. Priests said that ordinary people were unable to rightly interpret God's word and needed guidance. Protestants said the Bible opened men's eyes to the errors of the priesthood. Both sides saw reading the Bible as the central issue of the religious conflict that had swept Europe. Gilles' employees had claimed they knew nothing of these sheets. They had only worked on Latin Bibles and other permitted works, they said. Gilles must have printed the others himself at night after they had gone home. They had been fined just the same, but had escaped the death penalty. When a man was executed for heresy, all his goods were confiscated. This law was applied patchily, and interpretation could vary. But Gilles lost everything, and his wife and daughter were left destitute. They managed to escape with the cash in the shop before it was taken over by a rival printer. Later they went back to beg for their clothes, and learned they had been sold. There was a big market for second-hand garments. They were now living in one room of a tenement. Sylvie was a poor seamstress. She had been raised to sell books, not to make clothes, so she could not even take in sewing, the traditional last resort of the penniless middle-class woman. The only work she could get was doing laundry for Protestant families. Despite the raids, most of them still adhered to the true religion, and after paying their fines, they had swiftly restarted their congregations, finding new places to worship in secret. People who knew Sylvie from the old days often paid her more than the usual price for laundry, but still, it was not enough to keep two people in food and fuel, and gradually the money they had brought from the shop was spent. It ran out in a bitterly cold December, with an icy wind knifing through the high, narrow Paris streets. One day when Sylvie was washing a bedsheet for Jeanne Mauriac in the freezing water of the Seine River, the cold hurting her hands so badly that she could not stop crying, a man passing by offered her 5 sous to suck his cock. She shook her head silently and carried on washing the sheet, and he went away. But she could not stop thinking about it. 5 sous, 60 pennies, 1/4 of a livre. It would buy a load of firewood, a leg of pork, and bread for a week. And all she had to do was put a man's thing in her mouth. How could that be worse than what she was doing now? It would be a sin, of course, but it was hard to care about sin when her hands were in such agony. She took the sheet home and hung it across the room to dry. The last lot of wood was almost gone. Tomorrow she would not be able to dry laundry, and even Protestants would not pay if she delivered their sheets wet. She did not sleep much that night. She wondered why anyone would desire her. Even Pierre had only been pretending. She had never thought herself beautiful, and now she was thin and unwashed. Yet the man at the waterside had wanted her, so perhaps others would. In the morning she bought 2 eggs with the last of her money. She put the remaining fragments of wood on the fire and cooked the eggs, and she and her mother had 1 each, with the stale remains of last week's bread. Then they had nothing. They would just starve to death. God will provide, the Protestants always said, but he had not. Sylvie combed her hair and washed her face. She had no mirror, so she did not know what she looked like. She turned her stockings inside out to hide the dirt. Then she went out. She was not sure what to do. She walked along the street, but no one propositioned her. Of course not. Why would they? She had to proposition them. She tried smiling at men as they walked by, but none responded. To one she said, "I'll suck your cock for 5 sous," but he just looked embarrassed and hurried on. Perhaps she should show her breasts, but it was cold. She saw a young woman in an old red coat hurrying along the street with a well-dressed, middle-aged man holding his arm as if afraid he might escape. The woman gave her a hard look that might have signified recognition of a rival. Sylvie would have liked to speak to her, but the woman seemed intent on going somewhere with the man, and Sylvie heard her say to him, "It's just around the corner, my darling." Sylvie realized that if she succeeded in getting a customer, she would have nowhere to take him. She found herself in the Rue du Mur, across the street from the warehouse where the Palo family had stored illegal literature. It was not a busy thoroughfare, but perhaps men would be more willing to deal with prostitutes in back streets. And sure enough, a man stopped and spoke to her.
"Nice tits," he said.
Her heart leaped. She knew what she had to say next.
"I'll suck your cock for 5 sous."
She felt nauseated. Was she really going to do this? But she was hungry and cold. The man said,
"How much for a fuck?"
She had not thought about that. She did not know what to say. The man was irritated by her hesitation.
"Where's your room?"
he said.
"Nearby?"
Sylvie could not take him back to where her mother was.
"I haven't got a room," she said.
"Stupid cow,"
the man said, and he walked away. Sylvie could have cried. She was a stupid cow. She had not worked this out. Then she looked across the road at the warehouse. The illegal books had presumably been burned. The new printer might have been using the warehouse, or he might have leased it to someone else. But the key might still be behind the loose brick. Perhaps the warehouse could be her room. She crossed the road. She pulled out the loose half-brick next to the doorpost and reached inside. The key was there. She took it out and replaced the brick. She cleared some rubbish from in front of the warehouse door with her foot. She turned the key in the lock, went inside, closed and barred the door behind her, and lit the lamp. The place looked the same. The floor-to-ceiling barrels were still there. Between them and the wall, there was enough space to do what Sylvie planned. There was a rough stone floor. This would be her secret room of shame. The barrels looked dusty, as if the warehouse was no longer used much. She wondered whether the empty barrels were still in the same place. She tried moving one, and lifted it easily. She saw that there were still boxes of books behind the barrels. A bizarre possibility occurred to her. She opened a box. It was full of French Bibles. How had this happened? She and her mother had assumed the new printer had seized everything, but clearly he had never found out about the warehouse. Sylvie frowned, thinking. Father had always insisted on secrecy. Even the men working for him had not known about the warehouse, and Sylvie had been ordered not to tell Pierre until after they were married. Nobody knew except Sylvie and her mother. So all the books were still there, hundreds of them, and they were valuable if she could find people with the courage to buy them. Sylvie took out a French Bible. It was worth a lot more than the 5 sous she had hoped to get on the street. As in the past, she wrapped it in a square of coarse linen and tied it up with string. Then she left the warehouse, carefully locking it behind her and hiding the key. She walked away, full of new hope. Back at the tenement, Isabel was staring into a cold fire. Books were costly, but to whom could Sylvie sell? Only Protestants, of course. Her eye fell on the sheet she had washed yesterday. It belonged to Jean Mauriac, a member of the congregation that used to worship at the hunting lodge in the suburb of Saint-Jacques. Her husband, Luc, was a cargo broker, whatever that meant. She had not previously sold him a Bible, she thought, though he could certainly afford one. But would he dare, only 6 months after Cardinal Charles' raids? The sheet was dry. She made her mother help her fold it. Then she wrapped it around the book and took the package to the Mauriac house. She timed her visit so that she would catch the family at the midday meal. The maid looked at her shabby dress and told her to wait in the kitchen, but Sylvie was too desperate to be thwarted by a maid. She pushed her way into the dining room. The smell of pork cutlets made her stomach hurt. Luc and Jeanne were at the table with Georges, their son. Luc greeted Sylvie cheerily. He was always lively. Jeanne looked wary. She was the anchor of the family and often seemed pained by the humorous banter of her husband and son. Young Georges had once been an admirer of Sylvie's, but now he could hardly bring himself to look at her. She was no longer the well-dressed daughter of a prosperous printer. She was a grubby pauper. Sylvie unwrapped the sheet and showed the book to Luc, who, she reckoned, was most likely to buy.
"As I recall, you don't have a Bible in French yet," she said. "This is a particularly beautiful edition. My father was proud of it. Take it. Have a look.
She had learned long ago that a customer was more likely to buy once he had held the book in his hands. Luke leafed through the volume admiringly.
We should have a French Bible, he said to his wife.
Sylvie smiled at Jeanne and said,
It would surely please the Lord.
Jeanne said,
It's against the law.
It's against the law to be Protestant,
her husband said. We can hide the book. He looked at Sylvie.
How much is it?
My father used to sell this for 6 livres, she said.
Jeanne made a sound of disapprobation, as if the price was far too high. Sylvie said,
Because of my circumstances, I can let you have it for 5.
She held her breath.
Luke looked dubious. If you could say 4.
Done,
Sylvie said.
The book is yours,
and may God bless it to your heart.
Luke took out his purse and counted 8 of the silver coins called testons, each worth 10 sous, half a livre.
Thank you, said Sylvie, and 10 pennies for the sheet.
She no longer needed the pennies, but she remembered how her hands had hurt washing it, and she felt the money was hers. Luke smiled and gave her a small coin called a dessin, worth 10 pennies. Luke opened the book again.
When my partner Radiguet sees this, he'll be envious.
I don't have any more,
Sylvie said quickly. The rarity of Protestant books kept the price high, and her father had taught her never to let people know there were plenty.
If I come across another one, I'll go and see Radiguet.
Please do.
But don't tell him how cheaply you got it.
Luke smiled conspiratorially.
Not until after he's paid you, anyhow.
Sylvie thanked him and left. She was so weak with relief that she could not find the energy to feel exultant. She went into the next tavern she saw and ordered a tankard of beer. She drank it quickly. It eased the pain of hunger. She left, feeling light-headed. Closer to home, she bought a ham, cheese, butter, bread, and apples, and a small jar of wine. She also bought a sack of firewood and paid a boy 10 pennies to carry it for her. When she entered the tenement room, her mother gazed in astonishment at her purchases.
Hello, mother,
Sylvie said.
Our troubles are over.
In a monumental sulk, Pierre got married for the second time 3 days after Christmas 1559. He was determined that the wedding would be a perfunctory affair. He was not going to pretend to celebrate. He invited no guests and planned no wedding breakfast. He did not want to look like a poor man, so he wore his new dark grey coat, which was appropriately sombre, fitting his mood. He arrived at the parish church as the clock was striking the appointed hour. To his horror, Véronique de Guise was there. She was sitting at the back of the little church, with half a dozen Guise maids, presumably friends of Odette's. Nothing could be worse, to Pierre, than for Véronique to witness his humiliation. She was the woman he really wanted to marry. He had talked to her, charmed her, and done his best to give her the impression that they were on the same social level. This had been a fantasy, as Cardinal Charles had made brutally clear. But for Véronique to actually see Pierre marrying her maid was too excruciatingly painful. He wanted to walk out of the church. Then he thought of his reward. At the end of this ordeal, he would sign the register with his new name, Pierre Aumond de Guise. It was his dearest wish. He would be a recognized member of the lofty Guise family, and no one would be able to take that away from him. He would be married to an ugly maid who was pregnant with someone else's child, but he would be a Guise. He gritted his teeth and vowed to bear the pain. The ceremony was short, the priest having been paid the minimum fee. Véronique and the other girls giggled during the service. Pierre did not know what was so funny, but he could not help feeling they were laughing at him. Odette kept looking back over her shoulder at them and grinning, showing her crooked teeth. Tombstones in an old graveyard, tightly packed and tilting in all directions. When it was over, she looked proud to be walking out of the church on the arm of a handsome and ambitious bridegroom. She seemed to have forgotten that she had been foisted on him against his will. Did she pretend to herself that she had somehow won his love and affection? as if that were possible. They walked from the church to the modest house Cardinal Charles had provided for them. It was near the tavern of St. Etienne, in the neighbourhood of Les Halles, where Parisians did their everyday shopping. Meat, wine, and the second-hand clothes that all but the wealthy wore. Without invitation, Véronique and the maids followed. One of them had a bottle of wine, and they insisted on entering the house and drinking the health of the bride and groom. At last they left, with many crude jokes about the couple being in a hurry to do what bridal couples are expected to do on the wedding night. Pierre and Odette went upstairs. There was one bedroom and one bed. Until this moment, Pierre had not confronted the question of whether he would have normal sexual relations with his wife. Odette lay down.
"Oh, well, we're married now," she said.
She threw up her dress to reveal her nakedness.
"Come on, let's make the best of it."
Pierre was utterly revolted. The sheer vulgarity of her pose disgusted him beyond measure. He was appalled. At that moment, he knew he could not have sex with her, today or ever. Chapter 10 Barney Willard hated being in the army. The food was disgusting. He was cold all the time, except when he was too hot, and for long periods the only women he saw were camp-following prostitutes, desperate and sad. The captain in charge of Barney's company, Gomez, was a big, vicious bully who enjoyed using his iron hand to punish breaches of discipline. Worst of all, no one had been paid for months. Barney could not understand how King Felipe of Spain could have money troubles. He was the richest man in the world, yet he was always broke. Barney had seen the galleons loaded with silver from Peru sail into the harbour at Seville. Where did it all go? Not to the troops. After leaving Seville 2 years earlier, the José y María had sailed to a place called the Netherlands, a loose federation of 17 provinces on the north coast of Europe between France and Germany. For historical reasons that Barney had never quite untangled, the Netherlands was ruled by the Spanish king. Felipe's army, stationed there, had fought in Spain's war against France. Barney, Carlos, and Ebrima were expert metalworkers, and so they had been made gunners, maintaining and firing the big artillery pieces. Although they had seen some action, gunners did not usually become involved in hand-to-hand fighting, and all three had survived the war without suffering injury. The peace treaty between Spain and France had been signed in April 1559, almost a year ago, and Felipe had gone home, but he had left his army behind. Barney guessed the king wanted to make sure that the incredibly prosperous Netherlanders paid their taxes, but the troops were bored, resentful, and mutinous. Captain Gomez's company was garrisoned at the town of Kortrijk on the River Laya. The citizens did not like the soldiers. They were foreigners. They carried arms, they got noisily drunk, and because they got no pay, they stole. The Netherlanders had a streak of obstinate insubordination. They wanted the Spanish army gone, and they let the soldiers know it. The three friends wanted to get out of the army. Barney had a family and a comfortable home in Kingsbridge, and he wanted to see them again. Carlos had invented a new type of furnace that was going to make him a fortune one day, and he needed to get back into the iron-making industry. What Ebrima saw in his future, Barney was not sure, but it certainly was not a life of soldiering. However, escape was not easy. Men deserted every day, but if caught, they could be shot. Barney had been alert for an opportunity for months, but none had offered itself, and he was beginning to wonder whether he was being too cautious. Meanwhile, they spent too much time in taverns. Ebrima was a gambler, obsessively risking what little money he had in a dream of getting more. Carlos drank wine whenever he could afford it. Barney's vice was girls. The tavern of St. Martin in the old market of Kortrijk had something for each of them, a card game, Spanish wine, and a pretty barmaid. Barney was listening to the barmaid, Anouk, complaining in French about her husband, while Carlos made a single glass last all afternoon. Ebrima was winning money from Iron Hand Gomez and two other Spanish soldiers. The other players were drinking hard, shouting loudly when they won or lost, but Ebrima was quiet. He was a serious gambler, always careful, never betting very high or very low. Sometimes he lost, but often he won just because others took foolish risks, and today luck was with him. Anouk disappeared into the kitchen, and Carlos said to Barney, "There should be standard sizes of cannonball throughout the Spanish army and navy. That's what the English do. Making 1,000 iron balls the same size is cheaper than making 20 different sizes for 20 different guns." As usual, they spoke Spanish to one another. Barney said, "And then you'd never find yourself trying to use a ball 1 inch too large for your barrel, as has happened to us more than once."
"Exactly."
Ibrima stood up from the table. "I'm through," he said to the other players. "Thank you for the game, gentlemen."
"Wait a minute," said Gomez bad-temperedly. "You have to give us a chance to win our money back."
The other two players agreed. One shouted, "Yes!" and the other banged the table with his fist.
"Tomorrow, maybe," said Ibrima. "We've been playing all afternoon, and I want a drink, now that I can afford one." "Come on, one more hand, double or nothing. You don't have enough money left for that bet. I'll owe you. Debts make enemies. Come on!"
"No, Captain."
Gomez stood up, knocking the table over. He was 6 feet tall and broad in proportion, and he was flushed with sherry wine. He raised his voice.
"I say yes."
The others in the tavern moved away, seeing what was coming. Barney stepped toward Gomez and said in a quiet voice, "Captain, let me buy you another drink. Yours has spilled."
"Go to hell, you English savage," Gomez roared.
Spaniards considered Englishmen to be northern barbarians, just as the English regarded the Scots.
"He has to play on."
"No, he doesn't." Barney spread his arms in a let's-be-reasonable gesture. "The game has to stop sometime, doesn't it?"
"I'll say when it stops. I'm the captain."
Carlos joined in. "That's not fair," he said indignantly. He was quick to be angered by injustice, perhaps because he had suffered so much himself.
"We're all equal when the cards are dealt."
He was right. It was the rule when officers gambled with enlisted men.
"You know that, Captain Gomez, and you can't pretend you don't."
Ibrima said, "Thank you, Carlos," and he stepped away from the fallen table.
"Get back here, you black devil," said Gomez.
On the rare occasions when Ibrima got into an argument, sooner or later his antagonist would use skin color in an insult. It was tediously predictable. Fortunately, Ibrima's self-control was formidable, and he never took the bait. He did not respond to Gomez's jibe, except to turn his back. Like all bullies, Gomez hated to be ignored. Furious, he hit Ibrima from behind. It was a wild, drunken punch, and it only clipped Ibrima's head. But the fist at the end of the arm was the iron artificial hand, and Ibrima staggered and fell to his knees. Gomez came after Ibrima, obviously intending to hit him again. Carlos grabbed the captain from behind, trying to restrain him. Gomez was now enraged and out of control. He struggled. Carlos was strong, but Gomez was stronger, and he fought free of Carlos's grasp. Then, with his good hand, he drew his dagger. Barney now joined in. He and Carlos tried desperately to restrain Gomez, while Ibrima struggled to his feet, still dazed. Gomez threw off both his assailants and stepped toward Ibrima, raising his knife arm high in the air. Barney realized fearfully that this was no longer a mere tavern brawl. Gomez was intent on murder. Carlos grabbed for Gomez's knife arm, but Gomez batted him sideways with a sweeping blow of his iron-handed arm. But Carlos had delayed Gomez for 2 seconds, just enough time for Barney to draw his own weapon, the 2-foot-long Spanish dagger with the disc-shaped hilt. Gomez's knife arm was high in the air, his iron hand extended outward for balance. His front was undefended. As Gomez brought his knife down, aiming for the exposed neck of the dazed Ibrima, Barney swung his dagger in a wide arc and stabbed Gomez in the left side of his chest. It was a lucky stroke, or perhaps a very unlucky one. Although Barney had swung wildly, the sharp, double-edged steel blade slipped neatly between Gomez's ribs and penetrated deep into his chest. His roar of pain ended abruptly after half a second. Barney jerked out the blade, and a gush of bright red blood came out after it. He realized the blade had reached Gomez's heart. A moment later, Gomez collapsed, his knife falling from limp fingers. He hit the floor like a felled tree. Barney stared in horror. Carlos cursed. Ibrima, coming out of his daze, said, "What have we done?" Barney knelt down and felt Gomez's neck for a pulse. There was none. The blood had stopped pumping from the wound.
"Dead,"
Barney said. Carlos said, "We've killed an officer." Barney had stopped Gomez murdering Ibrima, but that would be difficult to prove. He looked around the room and saw that the witnesses were leaving as fast as they could go. No one would bother to investigate the rights and wrongs of this. It was a tavern brawl, and an enlisted man had killed an officer. The army would have no mercy. Barney noticed the owner of the tavern giving instructions, in the West Flemish dialect, to a teenage boy who hurried away a moment later.
"They'll be sending for the city guard," Barney said.
Carlos said, "The men are probably stationed in the city hall. In 5 minutes we'll be under arrest." Barney said, "And I'll be as good as dead."
"Me too," said Carlos. "I helped you."
Ibrima said, "There'll be scant justice for an African." Without further discussion, they ran to the door and out into the marketplace. Behind a cloudy sky, the sun was setting, Barney saw. That was good. Twilight was only a minute or two away. He shouted, "Head for the waterfront!" They dashed across the square and turned into Leierstraat, the street that ran down to the river. It was a busy thoroughfare in the heart of a prosperous city, full of people and horses, loaded handcarts, and porters struggling under heavy burdens.
"Slow down," Barney said. "We don't want everyone to remember which way we went."
At a brisk walk, they were still somewhat conspicuous. People would know they were soldiers by their swords. Their clothes were mismatched and unmemorable, but Barney was tall, with a bushy red beard, and Ibrima was African. But it would soon be night. They reached the river.
"We need a boat," Barney said.
He could handle most types of craft. He had always loved sailing. There were plenty of vessels in sight, tied up at the water's edge or anchored in mid-river. However, few people were foolish enough to leave a boat unprotected, especially in a city full of foreign troops. All the larger craft had watchmen, and even small rowing boats were chained up with their oars removed. Ibrima said,
"Get down. Whatever happens, we don't want people to see."
They knelt down in the mud. Barney looked around desperately. They did not have much time. How long would it be before the city guard began to search the riverside? They could free a small boat, breaking the attachment of chain to wood, but without oars they would be helpless, drifting downstream, unable to steer, easy to catch. It might be better to swim to a barge, overcome the watchman, and raise the anchor. But did they have time? And the more valuable the craft, the more intense would be the pursuit. He said,
"I don't know. Maybe we should cross the bridge and take the first road out of town."
Then he saw the raft. It was an almost worthless vessel, just a dozen or so tree trunks roped together, with a low shed in which one man might sleep. Its owner stood on deck, letting the current carry him, using a long pole to steer. Beside him was a pile of gear that looked, in the twilight, like ropes and buckets that might have been used for fishing.
"That's our boat," said Barney. "Softly does it."
Still on his knees, he slipped into the river. The others followed. The water got deeper quickly, and soon they were up to their necks. Then the raft was almost upon them. All three grabbed its edge and hauled themselves up. They heard the voice of the old man yelling in shock and fear. Then Carlos was on him, wrestling him to the deck, covering his mouth so that he could not call for help. Barney managed to grab the pole he had dropped before it was lost, and he steered the boat into midstream. He saw Ibrima rip off the man's shirt and stuff it in his mouth to silence him, then pick a length of rope from the tangle and bind the man's wrists and ankles. The three friends worked well as a team, Barney reflected, no doubt because of the time they had spent jointly managing and firing a heavy cannon. Barney looked around. As far as he could see, no one had witnessed their hijack of the raft. What now? Barney said, "We're going to have..." "Shut up," said Ebrima. "What? Be careful what you say. Give nothing away. He may understand Spanish." Barney saw what he meant. Sooner or later, the old man was going to tell someone what had happened to him, unless they killed him, which none of them would want to do. He would be questioned about his captors. The less he knew, the better. Ebrima was 20 years older than the other two, and this was not the first time his wisdom had restrained their impulses. Barney said, "But what will we do with him?" "Keep him with us until we're out in the fields, then dump him on the riverbank bound and gagged. He'll be all right, but he won't be found until morning. By then we'll be well away." Ebrima's plan made sense, Barney thought. Then what would they do? Travel by night and hide in the daytime, he thought. Every mile farther away from Kotrek made it more difficult for the authorities to find them. And then what? If he remembered aright, this river flowed into the Scheldt, which went to Antwerp. Barney had a relative in Antwerp, Jan Voelman, his late father's cousin. Come to think of it, Carlos, too, was related to Jan Voelman. The trading nexus, Malcolm, Antwerp, Calais, Seville, had been set up by four cousins: Barney's father, Edmund Willard, Edmund's brother, Uncle Dick, Carlos's father, and Jan. If the three fugitives could reach Antwerp, they would probably be safe. Darkness fell. Barney had blithely assumed they would travel by night, but steering the raft was difficult in the dark. The old man had no lantern, and anyway they would not want to show a flame for fear of being spotted. The faintest imaginable starlight penetrated the clouds. Sometimes Barney was able to see the river ahead, and sometimes he blindly ran the raft into the bank and had to push off again. Barney felt strange and wondered why, then remembered that he had killed a man. Odd how such a dreadful thing could fall from his consciousness, only to return as a shock. His mood was as dark as the night, and he felt edgy. His mind returned to the way Gomez had fallen, as if life had left him even before he hit the floor. It was not the first time Barney had killed. He had fired cannonballs from a distance into advancing troops, and had seen them fall by the dozen, dead or fatally wounded. But somehow that had not touched his soul, perhaps because he could not see their faces as they died. Killing Gomez, by contrast, had been a horribly intimate act. Barney could still feel the sensation in his wrist, as the blade of his dagger first met and then penetrated Gomez's body. He could see the gush of bright blood from a living, beating heart. Gomez had been a hateful man, and his death was a blessing to the human race, but Barney could not feel good about it. The moon rose and shone fitfully through gaps in the clouds. During a period of better visibility, they dumped the old man at a spot that seemed, as best they could judge, to be far from habitation. Ebrima carried him to a dry place well above the river and made him comfortable. From the boat, Barney heard Ebrima speak to the man in low tones, perhaps apologizing. That was reasonable. The old fellow had done nothing to deserve this. Barney heard the chink of money. Ebrima got back on board and Barney poled away. Carlos said to Ebrima, "You gave him the money you won from Gomez, didn't you?" Ebrima shrugged in the moonlight. "We stole his raft. It was his living. And now we're broke." "You were broke already," Ebrima said sharply. "Now I'm broke too." Barney thought some more about pursuit. He was not sure how energetically they would be chased. The city authorities did not like a murder, but victim and perpetrators were Spanish soldiers, and the Kotrek town council would not spend much money chasing foreigners who had killed a foreigner. The Spanish army would execute them, given the chance, but once again Barney wondered whether they would care enough to organize a murder hunt. The army might well go through the motions and give up quite soon. Ebrima was quiet and thoughtful for a while. Then he spoke solemnly. "Carlos, there's something we need to get straight."
"What?"
"We've left the army now."
"If they don't catch us?"
"Yes.
When we boarded the Jose Maria, you told the officer I was a free man.
Carlos said, I know. Barney sensed the tension. For 2 years, Ebrima had been treated as a regular soldier, an exotic-looking one, but no more a slave than the rest of them. What was his position now?
Ebrima said, Am I a free man in your eyes, Carlos?
Barney noted that phrase, in your eyes. It meant that Ebrima was a free man in his own eyes. Barney was not sure how Carlos felt about this. Ebrima's slavery had not been discussed since that moment on the Jose y Maria. There was a long pause. Then Carlos said, You're a free man, Ebrima.
Thank you. I'm glad we understand each other.
Barney wondered what Ebrima would have done if Carlos had said no. The clouds began to break. In the better light, Barney was able to keep the raft in midstream and they moved faster. After a while, Carlos said, Where does this river lead anyway?
Antwerp, said Barney. We're going to Antwerp.
Ebrima did not know whether to believe